a couple of new faces, right? Is that right? Okay, so they're new people in the room. If you can, put your hands together and repeat after me. Namaste.
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 When my soul meets your soul, I greet the God within you. And before I start any session, that's part of acknowledging that we bring wisdom and experience and knowledge into a room, whether we are there to be a learner or a teacher. And I just want to acknowledge that wisdom in the room and the experience in the room. And as we talk together, look at new and different things. I bring new and different things into this room, but so do you. And it's in that attitude that I stand before you. So I just want to repeat that and greet the God within you this morning. And I've had a wonderful time. This is my first time being here in Holden. Wonderful time getting to know this audience, this special group of people. And it's interesting to talk about culture. And I know that many of you have traveled, and many of you have interacted with the other, whether that other is creation or whether that other is someone who's radically different, or the other is someone that's within our own family, whether it's a political other, whether it's a social other, whether it's a cultural other. We spend a lot of time. My name is Sunita Murtha, and I work at the churchwide office in Global Mission Unit, and part of my work is about education and communication. And part of the work that we do is to invite people into the discovery of what mission is today. And always mission has been about encountering the other. But what becomes an important question in our context today is, how do we engage the other? How do we see the other? How do we view the other? And one of the most important things that's coming up in our context is, how do we receive from the other? And sometimes when we think about mission, we are so tied up about what we have to give and what we have to fix and what we have to do. And so it is a discipline of a different sort to be able to open ourselves up to receive, not just songs and gifts and baskets sometimes, but something that's a little more harder to do, something that's under the water. So as we have been talking through what culture means and what's really, it's actually inviting us into a curiosity about ourselves. And sometimes when we are in a relationship or in this journey about finding out about the other, we're so curious about the other that we forget that we are curious beings ourselves, that we are complex ourselves, that we might not know ourselves as well as we think we know ourselves. And sometimes it's not being overwhelmed by what we don't know, but living in the mystery of it and continuing to be like children in our learning and continuing to be excited by what we don't know and not being overwhelmed by what we know and having the ability to just sit with some wisdom questions. And so just to give you a summary of what this group has been doing, the group that has been following these workshops, is that the first day we just talked about what is culture, and sometimes we think about culture as the things that we can see, touch, feel, hear, the things that we see, which are usually at the tip of the iceberg. But the invitation was to look at what is underneath the water. Come on in, there's more space right in front here.
Sorry,
no, that's okay.
Class.
We're in culture class, so time is Yes, come on in. So after sharing the summary of what we've been, the journey that we've been taking. So we looked at some of the values and beliefs. What is underneath the water? What gives behaviors their meaning? So sometimes the tricky part is that things at the tip of the iceberg could look the same. And what is under the water and gives meaning to the things that are on the tip of the iceberg are different. So we looked at examples I'll give you one example this morning, is the notion of modesty. For example, we sometimes don't even know what our culture thinks is as modest. We just have these gut reactions, and then we notice that, oh, your culture has taught you something about what is to be modest. And I took the example of women and how society views modesty. I mean, what is modest, and how women are supposed to dress modestly in India and in the U.S. And I shared that in India, you'd get more reaction from people when women would show their legs, whether it's like above your knee or just in legs. Legs have a strong reaction. I don't know why. But they do. Yes, they're beautiful, I guess. And so then I thought, you know, I knew that as I grew up in India, I knew that that's, you know, if you want to get a reaction, you should show your legs. And then, well, when I came to the United States, this was very curious because, you know, people would wear bikinis here, and I thought, oh, nothing was taboo. I mean, I thought there was no notions of modesty. But then when I started working among youth and then even working at the church-wide, when I'd see a reaction, it was when the midriff was shown. People were like, you know, there is a reaction. There is a reaction. And in the guidelines of dress code, if you go to a youth event, they would really tell tell the young people, cover it up. So I knew, aha, there is a notion of modesty here. But I thought it was really funny because we dress more conservatively. I mean, we really do in India. But the sari, if you have ever noticed and seen someone wear a sari, the midriff is exposed.
That's right.
So I thought, how fascinating, how curious, that, you know, something that's on the tip of the iceberg that we would think, of course, we have all the same notions of how we want to bring up our children, how we want to see things, and how we understand things. We have the same values. No, we don't. We don't have the same values, and we don't approach life the same way. And sometimes in mission, again, the thing is that in the past, in the history, what's happened is that we think we know what the other wants. And in mission, we have what the other wants. So that's happened as well. So I'm kind of tying in what this has to do with the work that we do, or with how we see ourselves as Christians and how we engage those that are different from us. The next day we talked about worldviews, then we started diving a little underneath the water, then to really, you know, talk about, so what is under the water? What are things that are these concepts, these values that shape us and form us? And so we talked about worldviews, you know. A culture becomes a way that you wear these glasses, you know, these glasses that are invisible. All of us have them, and we can't take them off. And what's very curious about is that it forms, it gives meaning to what we see. We attribute meaning to the things that we see because of the glasses that we wear. And not all our glasses are the same. And some things are invisible to us because of the way that our culture has formed us. And when you immerse yourself, or when you get the privilege, when you get the opportunity, like I have the opportunity to live here for a significant number of years, when you stand under something to understand something, then you get an opportunity to glimpse through someone else's glasses. And it is a beautiful thing. And so part of understanding culture is to say that there are different ways of doing life. There are definitely different ways of doing life. And sometimes in our rhetoric, in our global rhetoric or something, you will hear that there's only one way to do life. And part of the invitation is to create the space where to listen to one another, to way we do life differently, because it reveals the diversity that God has created us to be, and that we learn from one another. Actually, sometimes we are mirrors onto one another as we create that space. That it doesn't mean that in different ways that we do life, there are not justice issues, or that we don't do things correctly. We all know that. But we help one another see those things that are invisible to one another as we come together with our different worldviews. So then we talked about, so we know that this culture is influenced by philosophy, it's influenced by science, it's influenced by religion, it's influenced by so many ideologies. And so who you are at this point of time coming from a particular culture has a lot of influences. So we talked about what are some of the, we just picked on, we did a simplistic kind of picking on a Newton and Eastern Chinese Confucianism, what impact it had slightly on our worldview. So we went a little into that, and we started talking about this, and I can't tell you how fascinating it was to talk about this. Sometimes we think, oh, Lutherans have this doctrine, and we all know what it is, and then, you know, we're shaped by it, but we found out quickly yesterday that that's not true. So we just ventured in under the water a little bit about really what do we think. And so here are a couple of things that we talked about. We kind of rushed through that, and it was a great discussion. And I invite the same discussion again today. It is about people at their core. And the first thing that we talked about was that we said, are people inherently good? Are people inherently bad? Are they mixed? And people were all over the board, and it's a continuum also. I mean, I'm just, and then if you look into, if you get into cross-cultural studies, anthropological studies, you will know that actually there are people that different cultures that rest at different places there. And usually, where would you think Americans would land on that? People that live in the United States land on that.
Good.
Yeah, that people are inherently good, and that because another quality that's important to your culture is
individualism,
which is then a quality that's important for individualism is choice. So you can see what leads up to what. Is that people are inherently good because you do have a choice of how you would do good or evil. So that's basically, you know, again, it doesn't mean that all are clumped in one category, but that's usually the general tendency to where people are at. And then I this is what's out there, it's read that Muslims and even Shinto religion is that it's part of, then people, they think that people are inherently, well, they said that Americans think they are mixed mostly, and then you have a choice to make either that, and but inherently good. Muslims, Islam thinks they're inherently good. So that one example that they gave was that they have this way of doing, like, how you wire money, and that's really through relationships and human beings, that sometimes that money is transferred in the Arab world or among Muslim communities, is that you send the money to your mother here, your mother has an uncle over there, and then it's just by the word that money is given and transacted. And so that value appears in a behavior somewhere. And I share personally, because I love deep diving, I don't really deep dive, I'm actually very scared of water, but the iceberg water, I love it, because I do some, and I've realized, I said, what do I think? I realized that maybe I wouldn't use the word good or bad, but I would use the word broken, that when I encounter people, I'm usually more comfortable with someone who's vulnerable to showing me their brokenness. So I get suspicious of people that appear to me like they're perfect. Mm-hmm. So I get, and that's a behavior that, you know, I am suspicious of people, and I see that in my life sometimes when I, so it's an interesting exercise to go through. The perception of the world, and we talked about how this is like, with the Holden community, you can almost see what the perception would be, but what about the communities that you come from? And what this means is, What is the relationship between human beings and nature? Do we think that we're in control of nature, that we can control nature? Or do we think that we need to harmonize with nature?
We can fix it.
We can fix it. And then the subjugation to nature, that nature is more powerful than human beings. You better fear. You can come on in, don't feel, you're fine. If you want to sit down, there's chairs here and one in the middle right there or here. And then we talked about how sometimes, you know, a lot of people that live closer to the earth, like tribal people, they do have that notion that the nature is so powerful and overwhelming that you better watch out. You know where the power lies. And then you have, then I said to people here to pay attention to how the weather person speaks on TV, of how they would speak about weather, or whether that's about who's in control. But it's also of the conversation why, you know, Americans are more innovative or will get into those areas of genetics or microbiology or, you know, those things where you are. So it is. I mean, it comes with it's good and it's bad, but it also comes with a worldview of how you approach it. But we probably would be more. And I was sharing that in India sometimes that they would say things like, you know, when you want to learn swimming or something, they would say something, submit to the water. It's okay if you're drowned, but submit to the water.
That's the shadow side of that.
So that's an interesting thing. But we kind of know. It was a lot more clearer of where we understand our relationship with nature. And then, before I forget to say this, because yesterday too I did kind of forget to, part of the work that we see ourselves doing as the church is sometimes how we approach issues or how we approach the problems in our life or the challenges in our life, we approach it from the tip of the iceberg. You know, trying to explain to people information, giving people information about why you should do this, why should you take care of your earth, some practical problems. But sometimes we forget that people have this core framework. You know, the church for so long had taught, is teaching sometimes, that man is the crown of creation. And when you understand yourself and your value and all those things is set up in such a framework, what does it do when we have to shift? And sometimes I think the church is called to provide the faith language sometimes for us to work with our value system. How do we talk about this in faith language? How do we understand ourselves in relationship with this? And so I did want to mention that. And part of the time we are concentrating, instead of coming at issues from this side, we're going to start talking about both things, but in relation to one another. That sometimes when you because these are our foundations, you know, and sometimes when you pull the foundations from under people's feet, they don't know where they're at. And if people usually tend towards one issue, it's because they're afraid. Human relations, and then this is more about how we see ourselves in relationship to community. And this is one of the biggest differences that we might see as we are coming together, as the world is descending upon us, as there's no space where we're not intersecting. You know. And so the individualistic and the collectivist. Who comes first? Who's protected in a particular culture? In the United States, of course, it is the
individual
is king. So whatever is set up, institutions, things, whatever is set up, it's to cater to that and to protect that and to promote that. And in other cultures, usually in the South, it's more collectivist, which means that the community is first. And it's hard for the individualistic society to wrap their mind around that, because that's something that's done since you were a little child. If the formation that happens and the way the culture is patterned and modeled, you automatically think. And I was also saying it's not more noble. It's not about it being more noble. It's just the way that it's done. And it comes very naturally to people. And of course in that you have the good and bad in individualistic society, so you do have good and bad in collectivist society. But where do we land on that? You know, and then maybe tomorrow we'll see a map of where different countries lie on all these things. It's very, very interesting to see where they kind of, like, it gives you a general picture of where different cultures lie on that understanding of this. Perception of activity, and I'm going to send this over. Yesterday, we skipped this one, so I'm going to open that up for a conversation. Perception of activity. What do you think this is about?
Time.
There's no wrong answer.
Value.
Value? Yep. Mm-hmm. Value that you ascribe to activity, maybe. And so they're like, just like here is like good, bad, and mixed. Over here it's like doing, being, containing, and controlling. So what is important? What is the perception of being active? In the United States?
Yes. Good.
Positive.
Good thing.
Yes. Doing, right?
Productive.
Doing. I'll tell you a really fascinating. So I know that this is, we have some Episcopalians here also, but the Lutheran Church's tagline now? Does anybody know what the tagline is?
God's work our hands.
God's work our hands. And when I first saw that, I had to smile. I said, wow. And I thought, you know, and then of course when we're talking with the communication people and the marketing people, and what's a simple way to get people excited? Of course, the worldview, you know? And they said they had to do focus groups to come up with that. I said, oh, you don't have to do focus groups to come up with that, you know, because that's where people are at, and that's what, because that's what gives value. And, you know, some of us that are more from the being culture, so I was like, can't we have, I think the Holden community also comes from that kind of perspective. Can't we have God's dance and our turn? He's like, oh, you're not going to make this work too. You know, so it's so interesting once you start like looking. It's not, you know, it just keeps popping up in different places. And it's like, oh, that is so crazy that we would come up with that tagline again. You know, as we're so tired and overwhelmed with our task list.
Right.
You know? So it's the doing part, which is the action, achievement, accomplishment. You know, and so this is so embedded in our understanding of mission, if you know? Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, a very hard thing for us to ask people to enter into that conversation. It's not about doing. So then when we say being, you know, what's the impression that people have about being?
Passive.
Lazy.
Passive, lazy.
Not productive.
Yeah, not productive. Mm-hmm. And as we all find out over and over again, being is so much harder, I think, you know, it's because in particularly when it's not your center of gravity. When it's not your center of gravity, like when collectivism is not your center of gravity, it's so much harder to know how to be. And so when we're saying global mission is about relationships, and that's like, what are you talking about? You know? And so it's such a hard thing for us to, so, you know, being is the, it's almost the flow of events. How do you, when a culture is about being, it's the flow of events, people. And that's the flow that you pay attention to. So when you go to India or something, they say, or to Tanzania and places that have a different perception of time, you'd say, so when is church? We all know this, right? So church is when breakfast is over. So when does church get over? When you're done worshiping. And so when will we go home? When we get done with conversation. And so the rhythm, the flow of how people go about doing things is more with that. And so some of the things that we were thinking about in our work is like, what would an event... So then I became really good at your culture. I said, okay, because I know what will be applauded in your culture. You know, if I stand up for myself and see a good, strong Indian woman, they're like, yeah! And then also, like, I'm an event manager. And so what that means is that I know what minute by minutes are. Minute by minute. And so then we started thinking about it. So if we are, you know, part of the receiving the gifts of our companions, and then if we really take that really seriously, because it's so, you know, it is, you know, when the West comes at the South sometimes, you know, it's really obvious about the gifts that you can bring, and they are life-changing. If I don't have water and then somehow water is given, that is life-changing, that is life-giving. But when we say receive our gifts of the companion, because most of these gifts are things that you cannot touch, how do we explain that they are life-giving? When you see this unfolding right before you here in this community, but that is so much harder for people to understand and for us to really, really believe that that's true. But it is true. It is life-giving. And it is so much what this community needs, the community in the United States needs, to be able to receive the gifts, to be able to acknowledge that we're broken, and to be able to say that we also need. And so part of it, then, we were saying, okay, how does this transfer into, like, if you do an event, what rhythm can it follow? To invite people into, instead of a minute by minute, maybe when the sun rises, into the rhythm of the day. And so maybe it was a different model of the way that we gather. So that's another example of how we're taking something like this and then practically trying to ask ourselves how we bring that back into the congregation, so to help people understand how do you receive. And then containing and controlling, it is this way of activity that you're about, that's between doing and being. The senses are moderated by thought. The mind and body are balanced. People restrain their desires by detaching themselves from objects in order to allow each person to develop as an integrated whole. And again, I see these examples of these that are in the Indian culture, and I don't know about, I mean, that's where I'm from, so I can bring a lot more examples. And if you think of other examples, please share, but you will see that, you know, part of the philosophy or the religion in India is about, or in Buddhism, a little bit about suffering, and or, you know, detaching yourself enough in order to sometimes enter into suffering. Or so you'll see that in different ways that people from that particular thought that they will live it out in that manner. And it is a very small section of people that will do that in India. But that's also, I think sometimes that I see that when your basic needs are fulfilled in those cultures, then you're able to think about the things that are higher on the ladder, then you start thinking that way. What can I detach from? Only a person that's had a lot of meat, I think, you know, will start thinking about. And some of that we see here also, right? You know, it's like, how do we, our consumption, you know, the things that are holding us in bondage, how are we taking those off? Perception of, perception of space. And someone asked me a wonderful, interesting question yesterday. I was talking about, like, how my mother would say the most terrible thing that could happen to me is for me to be alone for a few days. That would be the most terrible thing that could happen to me, and that's an indication of a collectivist society. You know, it's such a shame that you have to be alone. You know? And so someone asked me, so what would all the introverts in India do? Was that you?
Yes, that was you. You had a something on your tie dye and you're sitting upstairs.
That's a great question. And I said, well, we just are like,
they're around people, and then we just say, she's a little quiet.
And then, but we were talking about the perception of space, whether it's public, private, or mixed. And then we were talking about how Americans have a very specific 16 and a half inches of private space around you. You walk around, you like. And so if you really want to mess around with an American, it's that you enter that space.
And you can follow someone around because they keep backing up. You can move them across the room because you're entering into their private space.
And another example, when the perception of space is public, is that in India, though there's heavy, it's not that we believe one another's, that, you know, Christians believe that the Muslims are right, the Muslims believe that the Hindus are right. No, it's not that. We have the same battles that are happening all over the world. But the curious thing is, in our public spaces, the Muslims would be like, Allahu Akbar, you'll hear that coming out of their speakers. And the Hindu chants and bells will be ringing, and the Christians will be singing their German hymns to the loudspeaker. But nobody thinks it's wrong. Because it's the perception of this private and public space. And then we were just talking about the simple thing at a potluck when someone was sitting in the chair and they got up to get some water or something, and an international guest came and sat in that chair. For that few minutes that the person sat in that chair became their chair. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know that. So it's a interesting thing, isn't it? Isn't it amazing? And then, of course, the perception of time. And then someone said something funny, right? We could just do a sermon on this about the pew and whose pew.
Well, I get to thinking around that about the controversies about having a Christmas display on the Capitol lawn or something like that in a given city or community. And you know, that's public space, and therefore you can't do anything that might offend somebody else or suggest an opinion.
And I think I often take this conversation to understanding interfaith dialogue, and sometimes I say, in India, how interfaith interaction takes place is that I never grew up. It's not about having to deny your faith. It's not that nobody can say Happy Christmas. So sometimes I hear that conversation here in the United States where it's either or, you know, the dualistic thinking of, you know, so we give up all greetings. And it's happy seasons, or, you know. And thinking that that's interfaith dialogue, but you know, you have cake or something for Christmas, and then you have kheer for Eid, and then you celebrate Diwali with the Hindus, but it's all allowed. And so so you acknowledge. And so that's one way of, you know, and then so there's very different conversations that happen here around those, like the Ten Commandments over here, or, you know, and so those sometimes wouldn't be the conversations that we would have in India, but we would be having something different conversations that you would think are completely ridiculous. So perception of time, and I know that this is for anyone that has traveled, will knows what it is, you know, the perception of time. We talked a little bit about the rhythm and what's important to people and how they perceive time. And then how do we see time as eternity? Do we see time as scarce? What's the popular saying here? Time is?
Money.
Money. Money.
Don't waste time.
Don't waste time. So what do we do with time? What's the purpose of time?
Spend.
Yeah, again, it goes back to, of course, all these are interlinked. You know, they overflow. They're just flowing within one another.
I had a friend say something actually a few weeks ago when we've been on a retreat. I said, what was the best part of the retreat? He said, I stopped seeing time as my enemy and saw time as my friend. It's very interesting because a lot of us are fighting to cram as much into one day as possible, and then time becomes a combatant. And so I thought, boy, what a gift in a week retreat to really come back and set an enemy of time.
There's the pastor from Tanzania that is working as a missionary here in one of the synods, and he said, God gave us the gift of time, and he gave you the gifts of clocks. That's interesting, the measuring of time. Or, and that's such a gift. I mean, that's a gift that we can receive from one another, of how to loosen our grip on time. Any other thoughts that you just had?
I have a question on the human relations, the individual versus collective. Where does a society, like 200 years ago where you had a lord and then you had the serfs or something, that people have their place in life and you inherit that place in life, how does that fit into that?
That's very good, because yesterday it's about individualism, collectivism, and hierarchy. That's the third, and that's where that would fit. But it's a collectivist society, but then it's become a hierarchical one, where you know your place in life. You are to live for your in-group, to whoever you're assigned to, but it's in a hierarchy of relationships, the rule and ruled. So, but it's interesting if you look at that and then say, but there is holarchy. I've heard that word. I don't know, has anybody heard holarchy? Because there is a certain progression of things, or I don't even know how to say it, but for example, bacteria, but the things that are the single cell, and then it keeps going up. But the thing is to understand it in a way that we're the first ones to go if something should happen. You know, the things that last are the things that are basic, or they're more resilient. And so that's a different way of understanding that levels or expressions or the way that, and that's, I've heard it say holarchy instead of, but this is continuum of different ways of seeing ourselves. And then Bishop Mark will say, and you can tell where Bishop Mark is then when he said, we are an ecology of relationships. So we can say, we can tell where he's coming from.
I'm just recently into a retirement situation, and I found it kind of interesting that when people have responded to the news that I've retired, the first thing they'll say is, oh, and what are you going to do? And when I respond with, well, I was thinking of less doing and more being, they kind of look at me like, oh, what about, and they'll just walk away. But I think it's so typical that it's like, you know, so you're at the point of retirement, you certainly are still going to do something to be productive.
And some of the criticism that we do get, and of course, and I have to say, of course, doing is important, but I think we forget. Like, but with this culture, which is leaning so towards that, you know, to call people back into this. But the biggest criticism that we'll have is that what opportunities do you have for me to do in global mission?
I've been
been thinking about the what you've been saying about the individualist society that we live in, and what I'm wondering is we have become so individualistic because we can. We've had so much space here. Mm-hmm. We've been a frontier society. Mm-hmm. Do you think as time goes on and we get more populated, we will need to change that perception? Or
I really don't know.
Yeah.
But I feel that, and I was having a big argument with a friend of mine, so that it is a big, fresh thing for me. I think that it's harder to, again, it's the center of gravity, right? So unless you're formed in a collective way, like, you will never understand what arranged marriage is about if you weren't born and formed in that kind of a collectivist mind. I cannot even tell you. I can't even describe. So part of what happens is that this is our center of gravity. Wherever you are, or wherever your community is, and however you grew up, or what the culture that has given you is your center of gravity, and then you will have such a hard time. Now that is, will have to be hard time moving and putting yourselves in the situations where you will be moved from the center of gravity to see different things and to become. Because I faced that, but I was lucky that when I was a child, I did get that formation in me. I was here in the United States when I was 5 years old. And so I got some of that Western formation right there. And so I feel very lucky so that it was less hard for me to balance my life out. And then, but I would think that it was really hard to be born in an individualistic society, spend your entire life there, and then try so hard to be a collective. There are so many hands going up. Okay.
I guess I would just say that it really takes a lot of consciousness on our part to be able to make that shift. And so my hope for us to be able to move to be more collective, I don't know that I have a lot of hope because it takes so much work and consciousness to move even a little bit really in that direction. Because it is so difficult for us to see the world from a completely different lens.
It's not going to happen. We're going to find another frontier. I think our culture is so individualistic. If it's not moving west, if it's not the new world, if it's not the new frontier, it'll be the bottom of the ocean or the moon, or we'll find some physical or metaphysical way to find a new frontier and be individuals in space.
Yes.
And I just see that's what's going on right now politically with the healthcare issue is just to try to move a little bit. There's so much resistance. It's all enough. Just to move a little bit is so difficult because people are arguing that it's going to be swinging to socialism.
Well, I think it takes somewhat of a crisis in order to force people to become that way, whether it be a snowstorm where you have to rely on your neighbors in Seattle where you typically don't have snowstorms, or heat waves where you actually go and check on people in your neighborhood because they may be elderly or disabled and need some help and need water. But when you go out to communities further from Seattle and you drive through new communities, what you see is you see garages. You see two and three garages. You don't see the front of a house. You don't see anything that's welcoming. You know, people push their garage door open, they go into the garage, they leave and they go out of their car. But we also see in Seattle where there's now, and I work in a new community, but this has been built, where there are new communities where people are living in smaller spaces, and so that it has to take a concentrated effort. For instance, I have a full-time community builder, and that's what she does.
Right.
You know, she's there to help build community amongst different peoples that are living in a mixed neighborhood. Mm-hmm.
And then I again, you know, to remind people that, for example, at our event, we were trying to make things intergenerational. So the programming, even programming, where, and I can't tell you what work it takes to do that. And then we invite this community that, you know, this community from the South, somewhere in the South, they come, and then it happens naturally. And so, but that's just a show. And then for me, you know, I do some of these workshops with Indian women. I mean, I did it with an Indian conservative Indian ecumenical group, Indian women, and I have to tell you, it's incredible, and it's hard that way too, because you, like I shared yesterday, you feel like a thief and a robber, when you try to take care of yourself in a collectivist community.
I'm just curious, where does the economic system fit into that, and the difference between a collective culture, like you say, and an individualistic culture? Since we seem to be basing our, we have our economics based on working for self-interest, but in a collective culture, well, in India, I mean, it's a democracy and a market, but how does that all work? I mean, are there conflicts there?
If you come tomorrow, I'll tell you. But it's more in group. It's within you. Who's within your group? Mm-hmm. And so even in the collectivist, like I know who's in my group, and that community extends. So it's not a global family. You're not part of the in-tribe. So that's there. And so tomorrow we will talk about who's in the inside circle and who's in the outside circle, who's in the margins and who's inside that circle. And economics, but that's the thing. Even in India, to identify someone as an orphan is a hard thing to do.
Because they're part of the collective.
Yeah, it's because you always have someone extended, so it's really hard for an orphanage to find an accurate orphan. Because so even in that economics, mm-hmm. I mean, of course there's, but that's in group. It's their in group. It's not that the elite are taking care of. This is my collective. No.
There's a very specific in group.